Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Falcha Rasha Rish, you know the WhatsApp, 0870 32 32 32. Carl Kinsella, he's a journalist, he's on The Journal. I've spoken about him already. I'll tell you, his book is called At Least It Looks Good From Space. It's a catalogue of modern, millennial and personal catastrophes. It's out now in paperback. He's across from me. How are you doing, Carl?
I'm doing good, Oliver. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Oh, no, you're very well. It's not a memoir, is it? Or an autobiography or self-help?
It's funny you should mention that, because I found a lot of my friends are actually referring to it as a memoir, which is kind of a funny idea, because, like, I mean, I'm only 32 years old and I don't really have that many memories to fill a book. But it definitely, it's a book of essays that, you know, is mostly stories from my life and told in such a way that hopefully I'm making observations that are relatable and identifiable to other people.
Yeah.
And that people can read it and see something in there that, you know, whether it speaks to them on a level of it being humorous or it being hopefully insightful, you know. But I mean, really, it's just stories about stupid stuff I've done and me sort of muddling my way through life. And so, you know, that is what it is. And it is.
But you're not navel-gazing, not really like talking about yourself. You're talking about male friendships in general.
Yeah, so I suppose, you know, there's one essay that is kind of focused on male friendships, and it's about a time that my friends and I went down on a lad's trip to La Hinch.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, you know, the story, and I don't want to give away too many spoilers because I desperately need people to buy the book.
No, we need the anecdote for radio.
Yeah, well, they're like, I mean, the kind of core sort of story there is, like, you know, we were in a pub in La Hinch and we saw basically a group of lads effectively terrorize an American tourist.
Nice.
They managed to convince him to get up on a chair, and they were all singing happy birthday to him because apparently it was his birthday, and he started doing sort of a striptease kind of move, which I've seen men do that before, where it's like they're trying to lean into the joke but they don't understand that they're the butt of the joke, and his shirt started coming off, and eventually they got around to like trying to jock him and like pull his pants down. And
this is a group of, they were a friend group of men. You're in a different friend group.
Yeah, different group. Like,
watching,
you know, watching this unfold. And, you know, it immediately makes you think, like, what is it about a certain group of men that makes them enjoy that kind of almost like punitive, like bullying sort of behavior? And yeah, what is it about another group of men that, you know, you find that totally like antithetical to the way you would treat people?
Yes. But one group isn't going to chat to the other one and say, gentlemen, you're out of line.
Well, that's the thing. And I will say, I credit him in the book. My friend Johnny, who was with me, did speak up, and he was like, oh, that wasn't cool. But like, nobody said anything. I mean, like, I think this is the wall you kind of come up against as a man when you are trying to speak about masculinity, is that by even painting yourself as opposed to certain toxic elements of masculinity, I think you are immediately outgrouping yourself, because I think that the kind of guys who might be into that sort of behavior will immediately discount your opinion. Like, they don't want to hear, like, it's not like just because you're a man they're going to take you seriously. If you say to them, I don't think what you're doing is right, they will just ignore you. Now, of course, the way I see it is that if we were to, as a society, manage to get to a point where we have like a critical mass of people, you know, critiquing the way that men might behave. And just for the record, I don't want to make it seem like I'm slagging off men loads. Like, I'm not trying to say that all men are terrible by any means. But I do think that toxic masculinity is, you know, remains a major problem in life. I think it's, if anything, it's probably increasing if you look at, you know, the likes of Andrew Tate and those sort of figures.
Yeah. You're so curious as to the dynamic in a collective group of men.
And that's
you?
It. That's like, for me, I just have a huge curiosity as to how people end up one way or another. You know, why is it that you have certain behaviors and habits that, you know, attributes and inclinations of one type but not another type? And I just think it's so interesting to, you know, on a sort of sociological or cultural level, try to pick apart how we all end up the way we end up, which I think is kind of the core thesis of the book across the board. Yeah. You know, it's a consideration of like, why are we the way we are, you know?
Because you're into your sport, you're into football,
for sure,
and
yeah,
you've been in the chat groups and WhatsApp groups for football, but you've left some.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like there was one particular group chat I was in when I briefly played for a team. And like, just the kind of content that was in the group chat, I found it miserable. I found it upsetting. And so like, I just left. And I mean,
what was in it?
It was, you know, pornography, like, you know, just comments. You know, I don't want to go into detail, but like, comments that I would just find totally inappropriate and
but even sending porn links to your friends,
it's just a bit weird. You know, like
what point in the history have we?
Yeah,
did that taboo get broken?
This is what I mean. Like, it's not like, if nothing else, it's just, to me, it's just strange. It's just unusual behavior. Like, you know, like it would never cross my mind to be sending my, you know, like group of lads. I would never be sending them a link to porn. You know, it's not my vibe. I'm not into it. So I don't know.
This whole chat is about football, slagging each other of which team you support, kind of thing. It's a week. It'd be busy on the weekends, and then this is the extraneous stuff.
I guess so. And like, you know, to be fair, as I say, I left that group chat quite quickly, and like, I don't want to, you know, over-egg the extent to which I was, you know, like conscious. Like, you know, I was only in that group chat for maybe a week or two, and I'm not saying that it was like that all the time. But I do think that, like, broadly speaking, there needs to be a consideration that, like, in male group chats, you know, this is not a, I can't speak to how commonplace it is. You know, like, I can't say for certain that this is like a widespread phenomenon, but that's the sense I get, you know, just from chatting to people, from school friends, etc. You know, that there, to me, there's a vibe that it's more commonplace than it should be.
And
you know,
it wasn't,
I mean,
horrifying to the group. It wasn't,
I mean,
unusual.
I don't, like, I really don't want to speak to anybody else's mindset. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to speculate as to what anybody else, because it's entirely possible that, it's totally plausible that everybody in that group chat feels uncomfortable. Like, it's plausible to me that nobody really wants to be doing this. Yeah. I find that a totally plausible argument.
But they don't really want to be the person that says.
Absolutely. That's what, you know, and I say,
I'm fear of being a dry shite, isn't it?
Yes, and I am speculating, but like, I do think that probably for a lot of men, I think there is a discomfort in there that they are probably not able to verbalise. But like I say, that's my own theorising. I can't speak on behalf of men or anything like that.
We know you from Twitter for the pre-Elon Musk era, when Twitter used to be a thing you'd go on and find useful and funny things, or from the Journal. But tell us about you. You're from Dublin.
Yeah, I'm from Dublin. Yeah, from Fairhouse. Up Dublin 24. Up Chinelli's, up Coletti's, have to say all that. Those are my local chippers. But yeah, so Twitter was a big part of my writing career, I would say. Like, I think probably I wouldn't be where I am now if I didn't develop a following on Twitter. And like, my output on Twitter really was pretty chaotic. Like, it was jokes, but it was also pretty, like, I'd be trying to do some degree of incisive political commentary from time to time, but mostly falling back on, you know, dumb jokes and really the stupidest things I could think of. And I mean,
in the 140 character era.
Exactly, yeah. Those were the days, you know, the golden era.
Well, you had to sit and think for a while and then put it out.
Totally, yeah.
Did you get a rush when things worked on Twitter and you got the...
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah, I definitely did get a rush. Like, I think that was... I mean, that's why I did it, I would say. You know, I think I definitely seek a huge degree of external validation. I think Twitter was very handy in that respect. And to be fair, I did love the idea that I was like making people laugh and, you know, occasionally hopefully putting stuff out there that was on sort of a social or political commentary level, hopefully with some degree, you know, insightful or like a useful perspective from time to time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for the most part, like, my Twitter was just me trying to be funny, which sometimes I succeeded and sometimes I definitely didn't.
Because yesterday would have been a day, for instance, to go on Twitter traditionally when a big story like the heist in Paris or Liverpool losing the match, and you go for the funniest joke, don't you?
Well,
it wouldn't even occur to me now to...
No, that's it. I think the culture around it has shifted completely. Like, I think there's no... Like, there doesn't seem to be any impetus behind Twitter at all anymore. Like, I don't think anybody's... Because, I mean, Twitter and... Like, Twitter, I think, really made its name as almost like a live update app for news stories. You know, it's like, you know, I think it really kicked off when they got Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad all those years ago. And that really broke on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I think Twitter became a really useful resource for following things in real time when you couldn't wait for a news article to be updated and you couldn't, you know, all that kind of thing. But Elon Musk has just broken it. Like, he snapped it in half, basically. It's no longer useful as a journalist. It's no longer useful as a casual user. So, like, to me, if you go on Twitter now, it is just like it's like a cesspit in a ghost town. You know, it's garbage. So it's a shame because there was quite a strong, I think, community of Irish people who used Twitter. Mm-hmm. There was kind of what was known as Irish Twitter. And I think it really was useful in many respects in terms of, like, you know, there were plenty of insightful, really smart people on Twitter and you would just learn so much from those people. And I think it is such a shame that sort of And it's so ironic because Elon Musk kind of said that he wanted to turn Twitter into a town square. It already was quite an effective town square, and what he did was shutter it, basically. And that's where we are now, and it is a real shame, I think.
It's very hard to find anything useful. It's kind of across the internet and social media, isn't it? It's very difficult to wade through.
For sure.
AI slop and so on.
This is,
you grew up with a pre-broadband brain, you call it.
Yeah. Well, like, I don't think we got the internet in my house until I was about 12, which is obviously, there'll be people who, you know, will remember much more of their life without the internet. But I think it's an interesting age because it means people who are kind of my age they remember a time before the internet, and they can also see the future coming in the generations that have been raised only with the internet. And I think millennials and people who are born around the early 90s or whatever, we are sort of just on that kind of tightrope between the two. Yeah. And so I think your brain has been hugely impacted by the internet, but probably when it was very plastic, when you were a very small child, you know, you developed without the internet. And I think we're the only generation to have had that almost like hybrid development where you have without and then with the internet. You know?
Which is why it does strange things to the brain. So you get that hit.
Yes.
And sometimes Twitter doesn't bring out the best of us.
No,
even in
not,
its heyday. 2021, you go properly viral, don't you? And this is a harmless tweet you dreamt up about the Lewis.
Yeah.
What is going on? Why did you start this?
So the Lewis is free thing. And the first thing I want to say is, like, I can't take credit for like the idea of the Lewis being free. I'm sure everyone who has ever stepped onto the Lewis has thought, I could just not pay for this, because I mean, it does just sort of look like a free service, you know.
It was a common joke because we haven't used this tram service ever in Ireland before. Yeah, and somebody's so like, what? I don't have to go through a barrier.
It's like almost instinctively, you're just like, this should be free because nobody is here to stop me from just stepping on it. But so what I did was I just put up a tweet, and it was like, this is just meant to be a joke. It wasn't meant to go far or anything like that. And I think the way I worded it was, I said that I wanted to start a disinformation campaign.
You're quite honest. This is not real.
Exactly. And, you know, like, that the Lewis is free, and I think we should all stick to it until they make the Lewis free. And like, for me, it's a really interesting example of how the internet works, because I had actually tweeted a very similar thing about 2 years previous and nobody cared at all. Like, no, it didn't get any traction. And I think like my explanation for why it went so far the second time, and it really did go far. It was like 2 or 3 days of like nonstop tweets about the Lewis is free, everybody kind of taking the ball and running with it, which was really funny. But I think it really shows the sort of unpredictability of like what travels on the internet, because one day something could not capture the imagination at all, but another day it could be exactly what people want to see. And I think it's very hard to know which thing and whether good or bad, you know, like you could put up something that you really think nothing of, but people could, you know, they could humiliate you for it. You know, you could go viral and people are making a fool of you. And I think
the company behind Lewis was issuing statements that this is not true. Must have a valid
ticket.
That was
my one goal. Like, I, you know, I wouldn't have too many highfalutin goals, but like my one goal when I was doing that and it was kind of kicking off a bit, I was like, I really hope that like Eamon Ryan or like the Department of Transport have to come out and like by name be like, do not listen to Carl Kinsella. That's what I really want. I wanted a statement.
You wanted your moment on the floor of the Dáil.
Exactly. But unfortunately,
record forever.
The statements came out, but unfortunately I wasn't named.
Because Dublin Airport's official account even tweeted jokes.
They
saying
did, yeah.
Lewis is the Irish word for free.
I thought that was really funny that like Dublin Airport, that they're like, that their social media person had the degree of freedom to like be making jokes with the Lewis, you know.
And the Lewis operator with Transdev said the vast majority of people saw it was a joke and said they were coming up to the ticket checking staff saying, oh, it's free.
Yeah.
I've read on the internet. Do you remember how that did that feel good, or did you feel very worried?
No, it felt terrifying. I was scared the whole time. I just convinced myself that so many things were going to go wrong. I fully convinced myself that I would be like named in a class action lawsuit by all these people.
You really did.
So this is the thing.
Is
yeah,
this like, the start of paranoia feelings, or had you already got them?
No, I'd been having
building
years. And that's like, you know, as I say, that's a big part of the book, and it is something that is, it's a pretty pressing force in my life. It is something that I resent greatly, and it's part of like, I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and so that, you know, a big part of that is suffering from intrusive thoughts, which are essentially just thoughts that you don't want to have, you know, on the simplest level possible. But it means that you end up believing things and convincing yourself of things that are, I don't know if you'd clinically call them delusions, but they are delusional sort of thoughts, and you do end up believing them the same way that I like believe that my hand is in front of my face right now. So it is. It's not a nice feeling at all, you know. So in that case, yeah, I really did work myself up into a total lather, thinking that I would be sued by a group of people who felt they had been misled by me. And like, you know, they would get caught having not paid for the Lewis, and they'd be like, that damn Carl Kinsella lied to me. And that I would
be... Is this days, hours?
This would have been within like the kind of the succeeding 4 or 5 days, I guess.
And it lasts... It sticks with you.
Yeah, like, oh, it definitely does. It's thankfully I'm not as bad as I used to be, but I mean, there were certain incidents in my life, some that I write about in the book. Like, there was a time that I was entirely certain that I had cancer. Like, I 1,000,000% sure, went to doctor after doctor, and they would just be like, man, you do not have cancer. Like, they were, and eventually I didn't stop until I got a colonoscopy, which was completely unnecessary. Like, there was no clinical grounds for that at all. I just badgered the doctors until they referred me. And by the time I got the colonoscopy results, my brain had moved on to some other delusional, you know, perceived threat.
Always a fear, always
Something new. Yeah. And it is, like, it's something that I do resent quite a lot, because, like, you know, I'm 32 now, and I do feel this really kicked off for me in my life when I was about 22. And, like, I do think that it constrained me, like, hugely in terms of, like, creative output and career stuff. And I try not to regret it, but you know, for me, it definitely, for the last 10 years of my life, there have been several in whole years that have been almost kind of like a write-off because of how bad it is to have to deal with these sort of paranoid feelings.
And you, New York, being in America on a J1, not the best place to have.
No, that one really did me in.
Quite a severe episode.
Yeah, like, you know, I suppose it was, I was already not doing great. And then, you know, just being in America away from your support system, a huge part of it for me was getting up at 6 a.m. in the morning, getting on the subway, absolutely packed. Like, the stop I used to get off at for work was Grand Central. So you're talking about just throngs of people, and you are sandwiched between them. And I'm just so freaked out by the idea of contaminating someone who I touch off, or they contaminate me, or whatever else like that. And to sort of have to cycle through that thought process every morning, I think put me in a pretty bad place. So I think that's why New York didn't quite work out for me.
But you clinically have, this is obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, that's the diagnosis.
Not portrayed like this in movies, but this is the intrusive, terrifying thoughts.
Yeah, and I'm always conscious that, like, I can speak about my own experience of it, but I don't necessarily want to speak to anyone else's experience of it, or make it seem as though I have, like, a almost like platonic level understanding of OCD, because I think it is different for everybody.
Yeah.
But I think that definitely something that people at large might not understand because of the movies is that, like, when you see someone, for example, washing their hands repeatedly or engaging in a repetitive behavior, it's not the behavior itself that you should be thinking about. It's they're doing that because they are trying to offset some awful thought they have in their mind. And for whatever kind of disordered way that they're thinking, they believe that by doing this, they are keeping themselves safe, or that they are subverting this, you know, awful outcome that they don't want to happen. And so when you see someone washing their hands, it's really not the hand washing that's the issue. It's whatever's going on in their mind that's necessitating the
rearranging
hand washing.
Furniture, things like that. How are you now?
I don't know. I'm like, I'm better than I used to be, for sure. But I
you're being treated for it, aren't you?
Yeah. I take medication. And I mean, I'm not, like, currently in therapy, but I mean, I have done plenty of therapy over the years, and it's been really helpful. And I think just coming to terms with what it was and being able to talk to friends and family about it was a huge, like, having a support network is just a massive thing. And I owe those people so much. I'm like definitely a lot better than I used to be. I can notice things that, like, I used to, for example, if I used to get on the bus and take a receipt, I wouldn't be able to get rid of the receipt. I would just have to keep the receipt forever in perpetuity.
I see what you
and
mean,
like now stuff like that doesn't trip me up as much as it used to.
You can so, happily release it.
Yeah. But I also wouldn't want to ever paint it as feeling totally all good, because I think it's the kind of thing that can reemerge. There are triggers, and there are.
I'd imagine just with that condition, having those thoughts, that there's kind of the fear that seems to run through your generation, early 30s, of everything in the world, that fascism is on its way, that racism is everywhere, that men are getting worse and worse. That must be hard to manage then in your head.
I think it's hard to manage for everybody. Like, I honestly think that, because things like, you know, the rise of authoritarianism globally and, you know, whatever else you want, global warming, et cetera, those are all real things. So in many ways, I think it is actually quite rational to be worried about that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think for me, OCD occupies a space of it's exclusively irrational. Like, you're never worried about something normal.
Yeah.
Like, so I probably worry less about real things, like, for example, the rise of totalitarianism, than I do about some absolutely bonkers thing that I've just sort of concocted in my own mind.
Your comments about men's behaviours in WhatsApp groups has hit a nerve.
Oh, has it?
Quite a few messages coming in. It's definitely is increasing. I'm in first year and a girl, but I've seen all the boys from my old school beating and hitting each other for fun. It's not cool or funny, says Anya. My husband was organising a stag a few years ago. All grown men, mostly with families, had to change the group chat settings to him only being allowed to send messages because of all the porn and inappropriate messages that two people were sending. A bit like Carl, he was thinking, who thinks this is okay? My husband's age 60, male group chat. One man used to send racist, misogynistic jokes and content. He showed me his wife and I had to tell my husband why it was so inappropriate. We have two adult daughters. He's no longer in that group chat, but why did I have to tell him it was so bad, says Marion. And there are more messages like this as well coming in. So,
well, that
wasn't
yeah.
exceptional.
No, that's kind of what I was getting at when I say, like, I don't have eyes on every group chat in the country, but just from speaking to people, I do get the sense that it does seem to be quite a prevalent phenomenon, you know?
Yeah. Fair play to this chap. Total respect for being courageous enough to challenge the toxic behaviour. Doing the right thing is hard but necessary in these crazy times, says Rose.
I think that's a bit too kind.
This chap is Carl Kinsella, and he demands your attention because we're in the attention economy, and books, they do slow things down, I find. Like,
yeah, in the best way possible, I think it's necessary.
At least it looks good from space. Good title. Wonderful take on the chaos of the modern world and some of the praise it's getting there. It's out with Hachette Books Ireland in paperback, and it's a good crack as well along the way. We kind of forgot to say, it's funny.
Yeah.
By the way, you should mention supports as well, as we always do when we have these type of conversations, rte.ie/helplines. Carl Kinsella, thanks a million.
Thanks so much, Albert.
And good luck. We'll see you for the next one, because you're going to be writing, I think, forever.
Hopefully.
The two Johnnies are coming into us next.
Email oliver@rte.ie.